All right, we're back with part two on this gas podcast. My first time I've done a two-parter. How about that? That's because we had quesadillas and tacos to consume in the middle. So I'm going to pre-apologize for any burping. But we're having a good time. We're up here at Big Bear Lake. If you didn't listen to the first half of the podcast here, we had a great time riding around Big Bear together. And taking a little bit of break up here. And Charles and I have worked around each other quite a bit. We haven't really ridden together much. Did you come to any of my press
things? Yeah, I rode an Indian out of Long Beach or San Pedro or somewhere down there.
Yeah, we did the dark horse thing, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was a good one. It's all, you know, when you're running an event, it's like when you're the host of the party. You know what I mean?
You don't actually talk to anybody.
No, it's like you're just like making sure that, you know, nobody drove off the cliff.
Did we run out of ice again?
Yeah, or that one guy who's got some incontinence problem that's slowing the whole group down. We won't mention
that. That wasn't me.
That wasn't you. No, that wasn't you. Johnny on the spot, Charles. So talking a little bit about the institutions in motorcycling. I'm an AMA member, and I don't think any other organization has an opportunity to positively elevate motorcycling with the AMA. And I've been an AMA member for a while. They're not exactly big fans of me these days with the give a shift thing and some of that other stuff, because I think I'm challenging some of that. But I would say that the AMA has got this chance to really elevate grassroots conversation of motorcycling. And I think that's kind of what we're missing. And you brought up in a, you were on the give a shift panel, and you brought up that you ride with lots of different people who don't look like you, you know, who aren't, middle-aged white guy, you know, with a career behind them. But so talk a little bit, if you would, about maybe some of the younger folks you're riding with and kind of what you're seeing, the positives you're seeing out of that generation.
The interesting thing is that they don't come to the sport with the same background and the same prejudices that I came. Most people who are my age have had the same linear track to this point in their motorcycle riding careers. They had a mini bike.
The Z50
because
story.
They right. got it from their next door neighbor. And then they had a dirt bike, and then they maybe rode motocross or raced a little bit in the desert. And then maybe they got a street bike. And then maybe they didn't ride at all for 10 or 15 years while they were getting married or building a career or raising a family or whatever. And now they're 40 or they're 45 or they're 50 or whatever, and they're coming back. And they're interested in an adventure bike, or they're interested in a street bike, or an adventure touring bike, or whatever. But so that's this one path, and I think the motorcycle industry really understands that customer, and really understands how they think they can reach that customer, and how they can sell another bike to that.
Essentially,
customer.
Essentially, the customer that's dying off.
The customer that they've had, that they have successfully marketed to, that they know well. Where I think they have had weakness is reaching some of these other people that aren't already in dealerships, that aren't already reading motorcycle magazines, but that are aware of motorcycles because it's in the atmosphere, it's on the street. So I'm meeting guys who, for example, are buying their very first motorcycles at 35 or 40 or 45 years old. And I don't know how they're making their way through the industry, because there's no obvious place for them to make a point of contact with a dealer or even with a product. And once they get an idea of what they want, there's nobody around, there doesn't seem to be much around to help them beyond the dealer in their neighborhood that might or might not have a bike that's right for them and that might or not be interested in selling them or available to sell to them. We've talked, you and I have talked about the weakness at the retail level and often the casual indifference that the salesperson seems to have to the customer who just walks in off the street and doesn't really know what he or she wants to buy.
Right.
And God forbid it's a person of color, God forbid it's a person of odd size or unusual size, God forbid it's a woman. Yeah. Then the salesperson really may not know how to approach that person and what to bring them.
I think it's a real significant challenge. That's where I wish that to some degree the MIC tries to do this. I think they're a little bit hamstrung sometimes, but the AMA really shouldn't be. That should be about as agnostic and positive a force as there is out there for motorcycling.
But we as motorcyclists contribute to this too. I mean, how many how often do you see the adventure writer guy
yes.
that only tips his hand to the other adventure writer guy
yeah.
coming the other way?
Right.
Or the cruiser guy that does that, or the
right.
sport bike guy that does that. That weird kind of selectivity, that
right.
weird elitism that a certain kind of rider will have.
And, it's like and segmented elitism, right? We're all better than everybody else because we're not in the minivan.
Which is
hysterical. But we're all different from everybody
and
else because we're not on a black
and chrome. Is it 2% or 2.5% of the American population rides or owns or is capable of riding, is licensed to ride a motorcycle?
Right.
There aren't very many of us
right.
to start with, which you should think would make the deal of us all getting along well should be easier, not harder. But
well,
I don't think it is.
And that's really the challenge I would put forth towards whether it's AMA or MIC or any other, you know, group out there that is trying to elevate motorcycling, is like, let's talk about how to create categorical ambassadors within the current rider base. So if there's a challenge with dealer turnover that's making the dealer experience kind of sucky, so that's the core of that, right? If there's a challenge with new product is necessarily expensive because of what it costs to engineer and manufacture a new product. So therefore, you know, we got a lot of people coming into motorcycling with used motorcycles, which, by the way, doesn't get reported. There's no MIC for used bikes. So trying to find those numbers is almost impossible, right? So anyway, but that's there's certainly growth there, but whether you're riding a 25 year old Suzuki Intruder or you are riding a brand new CRF 250, that challenge of getting into riding as a new rider is exactly the same. And I think, to me, it's like there's a great opportunity for AMA to stand up and be that voice, be that buddy who's got the insights, you know, who's not colored by a particular brand, who's not coming at it from like I'm a track day guy, and so you need to buy an R6 for your first bike and that kind of stuff.
Well, and the brands could get smarter about it too.
Yeah.
I mentioned to you that I had a long conversation with Harley Davidson's president and CEO, Matt Levitich, and one of the things that he said was that he is trying to infuse from the bottom to the top of his company a new idea about what their job is.
Mm-hmm.
That their job is not going to be any more build bikes. Their job is going to have to be build riders.
Yes.
And they're going to have to find a way to recognize that if you're selling a big expensive motorcycle or a small inexpensive motorcycle or a used motorcycle, that's good for you in the long run.
Period.
Even if you're a dealer and you're selling an Indian instead of a Harley, or
mm-hmm.
you're selling a Yamaha instead of a Harley, that ultimately, that's good for everybody in the long run.
A rising tide mentality is what you're talking
Absolutely.
About. Absolutely.
Right. If you build more riders, if you inspire more riders, if you attract more people to the sport, if you break up some of the ghettoization
mm-hmm.
that says young men can only ride these bikes,
mm-hmm.
and young women can only ride those bikes,
mm-hmm.
and middle-aged people shouldn't ride these bikes, if you can break up some of that, you bring more people into the sport, you make the sport more approachable in general, and you make it easier for people to get interested in something that they may be interested in but can't find a point of entry.
So how is Harley Davidson going to do that with the brand that is the age that they are? And I know from past experience that their management style is literally, I was told, I actually interviewed with them years ago, but I was told in that process that the management style is a decision by consensus, right? Everyone around the table ultimately needs to be sold on the idea in order for it to move forward. The cynic in anybody out there would say, oh, that's least common denominator. And they're like, no, it's decision by consensus, right? So they're trying to elevate that process. But in order to have some radical change with a brand that has a much history of this, I mean, they're going to have to significantly change their approach.
Well, what may blunt the design by consensus or the rule by consensus is that it's not least common denominator programming for all customers.
Mm-hmm.
It's most available consensus among a passionate group of people who really believe in a product and a company. So that may make it a little bit less objectionable on that level. I think what they are planning to do, what they say they're going to do, what Matt Levitich says is not only on the books but actually happening now, is introducing new product that may not look like a Harley-Davidson but that has all of the spirit and the energy of the brand. That's going to mean smaller bikes. It's going to mean electric bikes. Mm. It's going to mean product that actually doesn't look like a motorcycle but looks more like a scooter, mm-hmm. looks more like a mountain bike. It's going to mean adventure bikes. It's going to mean naked sport bikes, things that Harley-Davidson hasn't built, things that Harley-Davidson can build and sell, presumably without cannibalizing its own customer base, because the guy who wants to buy an adventure bike might not be the guy that wants to buy a big bagger. So that's at least where they're putting their cards on the table is, we believe, he says they're going to be spending well over $500 million on this next 10-year plan to bring these products to market and to market to an audience that they think might not even be riding motorcycles at all, might not even know, certainly may not think that they're a Harley-Davidson customer, but may not understand that they're a motorcycle rider at all until it's made easier for them and more available.
Exactly the sort of thing that the single most recognized motorcycle brand in the world should be doing, right? So extrapolate, and like I'm imagining that going forward as I come walking into my current Harley-Davidson dealership wanting to check out their latest adventure motorcycle. Man, if the dealer experience doesn't change, it's just going to be a rerun of Buell or even what they, you know, the flatlined with MV Agusta. So that's going to have to be some pretty significant changes in their just general attitude.
I gather that he recognizes that.
Yeah.
That he knows that they've got a massive, powerful retail structure, that they bring this massive financial structure with that,
yeah.
That they are uniquely positioned to produce motorcycle sales, but that they're going to need a mentality change from top to bottom, and there's going to need to be great education and kind of re-education. And maybe even, who knows, I mean, you made the point that part of the problem at the sales level is that you often end up with someone who's selling motorcycles who isn't even going to be working for that company 6 months from now. So
right.
The education process may be a matter of training somebody to do something that he's going to quit or she's going to quit doing in the next 6 months. So it may be that there needs to be a different kind of a remuneration structure, a different kind of commission structure, a different kind of something.
Well, it could be an opportunity, a whole different type of dealership is what you're saying. I mean, we could get like Teslified here in a
Well, indeed,
a
this is part of the Harley-Davidson plan is to create some retail outlets that look a lot more like Tesla stores.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in urban areas or densely populated areas where the standard Harley-Davidson dealership would be completely undoable. So to do something that will give people the opportunity to sit on a bike, to do some sort of a 3D virtual reality test ride and look at all kinds of product, not just the motorcycles, but the apparel and the gear and the parts, and make a point of purchase sale either online in a sort of a virtual sales place or in a kind of a cafe-like pop-up store someplace in the middle of Midtown Manhattan.
I think that it was a little while ago, I don't know how many months ago now it was, that he said on an earnings call that the electric bike will be available in 18 months, right? Yeah, I think he said that.
They've promised to bring to market that LiveWire project in 2019.
Right. So that's another. We talked a little bit about electric motorcycles in our last segment there, but the that demo thing is going to end up being huge, I think, and that's going to be a really big play on this thing. But I think that there are just some things within motorcycling that it's a general attitude thing that's a real challenge. When, you know, I've done in my PR work, I did a lot of work with television producers and stuff. Every single time is like, get your motor running, is, you know, that's playing in the background, and it's like this, it's the typical, I mean, you could almost be a TV producer and just vomit out the same stuff, and the audience just sits there and absorbs it. But the truth is that motorcycling is fundamentally changing. The people who are doing it are changing, and that the companies are going to need to change in order to keep up with that and to make it continue to be a viable product out there. So I've not been a like I never daydreamed about owning a Harley Davidson. That wasn't like my thing. I came into motorcycling more from like super bikes and Aprilia and my experience like that. But when Harley had that, what was that, that XR 1200, the flat tracky inspired, right? I rode that bike. That thing had character. It actually handled pretty well. It didn't make a ton of power or whatever, but it was fun to ride. It got back, and you know, and it lasted all of what, 2-3 years on, you know, maybe 3 years, you know, here, because it just didn't fit what they're doing. But if they're successful at that, it's going to cause every other OEM to start to pay attention, don't you think?
Well, the rising tide lifts all boats, as you say, but it also demands the everyone up their game. So if the biggest retailer of motorcycles in the United States begins to play the game in a different way, it changes the rules for everyone. And it demands that others pay attention, follow suit, or come up with a better plan.
Or get left behind.
Or possibly get left behind.
Yeah.
Which is great, because they all could be working harder. They all could be... I mean, the sad fact is most motorcycle companies and most motorcycle dealers are doing today what they were doing when I was a kid.
Right.
It's the same structure. It's the same marketing. It's the same plan. It's the same program. The price points have changed, and the product has gotten better.
And the environment that you use it in has fundamentally changed. That's a big, big shift.
That's
us,
also
right?
True.
Yeah.
But the dealer experience hasn't kept pace.
Right.
And the manufacturing process probably hasn't kept pace either.
Yeah.
So who are the customers who are being left behind? We talked about this at breakfast today. You know, this idea of motorcycles empower and motorcycles bring you freedom and create the open road. Well, if you're marketing to people like me, the fact of the matter is I grew up male and white in America. I was born empowered. I was born free. Like, all of that stuff came with the original package.
Right.
So the idea might be to market that stuff to people for whom a motorcycle really does represent a different kind of power or a different kind of empowerment and a different kind of freedom. So people of color, women, these seem to me to be the most sponge-like consumers,
yeah,
of this product. If you're trying to sell power and freedom, we'll sell it to somebody that has less of it, for crying out loud.
Well,
and to people that have already like soaked it all up their entire lives.
That's one of the things that I'm most proud of in my career, and also in the Give a Shift report, is we said if we want to affect the fastest fundamental change in motorcycling, and OEMs only respond to sales, that's all they care about, right? Selling more stuff. So if we want to sell more stuff, the fastest way to do that is to make motorcycling approachable, more approachable to more women, period. Regardless of age or whether they're black or whether they're urban or country or whatever. So make it more appealing, more approachable to more women out there. And that's one of the reasons that I'm doing like this SCMR 2020 stuff, and I used to help run Femmoto and all that. So that's always been like kind of in the back of the head. But on the back end of Me Too movement, on the back end of, or, you know, as we creep up to the centennial of women's right to vote and stuff like that, it's like, hey guys, all you dudes in the, you know, in the marketing department out there who are scared to experiment with something new, this is an audience that's just ripe for this, that there's that kind of experience through motorcycling is literally just, it's a layup.
Well, and some of the mainline media is doing its job bringing attention to this. The Los Angeles Times had a piece out of its Pakistan bureau about a month ago, mm-hmm, about women becoming motorcycle riders there and getting mobility for the first time, getting freedom for the first time, and how fundamentally life-changing it is for a woman who can put on a pair of jeans and put on a helmet and be anonymous and run errands for her family or earn money for her family. And that this is an absolute game changer for some of those women. And then the New York Times just today had a piece about the Caramel Curves, an all-black, all-female motorcycle club in New Orleans. So it's in the wind. This conversation that you and I started having a couple of years ago has become a more mainstream conversation. And when I wrote a piece about Stacey London and her East Side Moto Babes for the Los Angeles Times 4 years ago, you know, that was kind of an unusual piece. And a lot of people said to me, wow, like, who are these women? I've never even heard of them. I don't see women riding anywhere. Well, the needle has already moved from that. So already the conversation has become a more mainstream one and a more national one, maybe a more international one.
Well, I certainly hope that all of us as riders and enthusiasts understand that that opportunity to bring women into riding is just, it's never been, A, more needed, and the opportunities have never been better. From a product standpoint, there's all kinds of great motorcycles, whether you're male or female, there's all kinds of great motorcycles to start your riding on, no matter what kind of style you're into, or even from a price point level, there's a ton of bikes that are under $5,000 new. Let alone all the used bikes that are out there. So, I don't know, that to me, that the opportunity is this big advocacy thing, and all of us as motorcyclists to begin to have more welcoming conversations with, somebody comes rolling up on a TW200 or whatever, is to understand that, man, if you got a motor and two wheels underneath you, you're in the family already, and just to make it more approachable and easier. So what are you seeing, anything that is like moving the needle as far as that, making motorcycling approachable?
I feel like in the casual conversations that I have around the world, among other things, I feel like I'm meeting more people who are not in my cohort who want to get into motorcycling, mm-hmm. and who think it's possible, who are coming to me and saying, I've made a decision, I want to start riding.
So
tell
me
how I can do that.
Right. Does that... saying that, okay, we're saying two things. We're not talking to that audience. Like, we don't know how to talk to that audience. So we is a big blanket statement. But the industry is not doing a good job of it. But yet they're finding the inherent positives and goodness of motorcycling. Is it just when looking at the silhouette or seeing it in its environment and other people doing it? So capturing that that energy, that interest, and I think... making information in an approachable way that's not driven by super enthusiasm and specs and stuff like that. That's a huge part of what we have to do.
Absolutely, and it's doable. And here's how I know that it's doable. If I show up in a public place, if I've shown up at an event or at a dinner or at some group thing, and I walk in carrying a motorcycle helmet, some people in that group are going to say, oh, wow, you ride a motorcycle?
Right.
Wow, really? Because I had this cousin.
Yeah.
And he broke his leg, and it's so dangerous. But then there's another group of people that will come up to me and say, you ride a motorcycle? That's so badass.
Yeah.
Those are the people we're after. The people that already understand without ever having slung a leg over a motorcycle, they understand there's something cool about that. There's something appealing. There's something exciting. There's something different about that. That's our target.
I think there's been some trickling evidence of the fact that I've said for years, let me back off of that. I've said for years that we have a challenge right now in motorcycling, that we have boomers are in senior management position. Gen X folks are in middle to senior management typically, and here's millennials are getting the blame, and Gen Z are getting the blame for you're supposed to be buying some stuff. So there's a generational language barrier within power sports that's a real challenge to get through, right? And we just know inherently, this is a human thing, not a power sports thing, older folks don't trust younger people. I mean, it's a problem, right? Because here's younger folks saying, like, oh, you got to change your business model, and you get lip service out of an OEM or out of, oh, yeah, well, we did this one little tiny thing once, and that was supposed to be a catalyst, and it didn't work out. There's got to be a level of commitment to this change to actually affect sales and to affect the community in a positive way.
Well, you're correct. It's going to have to start with product and follow with a different experience at the retail level, or it won't work.
Because
a certain number of people are going to have enthusiasm and simply find it too complicated. They're going to go to a dealership and they're going to discover
one negative experience,
that there's not enough money in their wallet for that experience, or that they're treated like second-class citizens because they don't already, the person that says, so what do you ride? Like, if that's the first question that I get asked when I walk into a retail store and I don't actually have a motorcycle, I'm already sort of being told, well, this is not for you.
Right.
We sell motorcycles to motorcycle riders here.
Yeah, it's like a little club.
So that has to change.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that not everybody is a motorcyclist, right? Not, we hung out a little while earlier. There was like a hang gliding launch point that we swung by when on our ride up here near Crestline. And it's like not everybody can imagine strapping a wing to their back and jumping off a cliff. And right.
That's right. Remember, we stopped there because we wanted to observe people doing something even more ridiculous than what we do.
Right.
So it's not for everybody. It's and not it, apparently for us.
And yet nobody was there. So that made us the most ridiculous
yes,
people on
we
the mountain.
We are the stupidest people on the mountain
That's
today.
Right. So, but that, I mean, I think that there, where I was going earlier is that there is some sense of an analog, or I should say digital blowback, that people are getting tired of their screens. We're seeing it in this van life thing that got romanticized. We're seeing it in tiny homes that are getting romanticized. That there's something about, you know, even marketing experts are saying that there's like experience is more important than possession right now. And that experience, I've talked to people who've like gone to Vietnam, bought a motorcycle for a couple grand, been riding around Vietnam, sold the motorcycle, came back home. And it wasn't about owning that motorcycle. It was about being in Vietnam and touring in a way that, that you cannot escape. The there's no cocoon you're in. You're in the environment, right? And I that rebound off of a digital existence that we're all sort of sometimes trapped in, man, motorcycles are just this great opportunity to deliver on that.
Yeah, it's a natural extension of I'm listening to vinyl on a turntable.
Yeah.
And I want to stay in a campground. And I want to do a cookout. Absolutely. This is desire for a more authentic experience, a more visceral experience, a more analog experience, is something that should be monetized. It should be monetizable, if that's a word,
yeah,
by the motorcycle companies, because what's more visceral, what's more real, what's more analog than you with your head in a helmet whipping down the highway?
Well, we talk about the motorcycle community all the time, you know, those of us who are indoctrinated and are in it. So I you know, I want to leave on the thought of like, we got to be less hypocritical about that. We got to actually, you know, put where our money where our mouth is. We got to if you really care about motorcycling, you got to do stuff to get more people in. There's a ton of different ways of doing that, you know, and we hope everybody kind of finds the way of, you know, their way. You know, there's a challenge. Here's an easy challenge. If you're a motorcyclist out there listening, just get one more person to be a motorcyclist.
Or even, here's an easier plan.
Oh, you got
easier. Here's an easier plan. This is something that
you got to get that guy to put a muffler on his bike.
Well, I think that's the third Honda Trail 70 that's gone past us in the last half an hour. I don't know. There must be a rally.
It's not the same guy.
There's a club. It's not the same guy.
All right.
So here's a more an easily achievable challenge. If you're a motorcyclist and you know other motorcyclists, organize a ride.
That's it.
Just organize a Sunday ride, because the fact of the matter is, and this is something that it's a very simple bonehead point that Matt Levitich made in the conversation we were having. He said, look, more people on more motorcycles makes for more motorcycle sales.
Mm-hmm.
If there are more people on their motorcycles on the road, that is an advertising opportunity that you can't pay for. You can't buy that. It's a billboard for the sport that can't be reproduced. So if there are more of us out there looking like we're having fun, behaving like ladies and gentlemen and not acting like hooligans, that's absolutely the best advertising we can get for our sport. And what's the one complaint that I hear from so many people who have motorcycles and don't ride is they all say, yeah, I don't know, I don't really know where to go.
Right.
And actually don't know, I don't know other riders. I don't really have anybody to ride with.
And which is the subtext of that is I need a community.
Yeah.
Right?
So we're the community.
We can be it.
So it's on us to, all right, I'll make a commitment.
Oh, here it comes. Okay,
here it comes. One ride in the next month.
One ride
will be
that's good.
Charles Fleming Invitational. Hey guys, let's all go riding.
Oh, that's great.
And maybe we'll come right back here to Fawnskin and remember this moment.
I'll make this commitment. If we can get at least five senior marketing sales CEOs to come to the Long Beach IMS show and go for a ride together, okay, I'll buy the first round of drinks.
Okay, I'll buy the second.
All right, that's a deal. All right, so that's, there you go. Matt, you're out there. Scott Wine, you're out there. You know, we got all kinds of folks over in the Japanese brand. You can even sleep in your own bed after that, right? I'll pay for the Uber. Maybe I'll even pay for the Uber. Maybe.
Wow.
I don't want to get caught.
This is turning into a big ticket item.
I know. God, I keep spending money on this stuff. Holy crap. I'm doing it wrong. Anyway, so that's a challenge, all right, from Charles and I in our second segment here on a Gasp podcast. I've been speaking to Charles Fleming, freelance writer, but formerly of the LA Times, world traveler on two wheels, fan of things with throttles, as I am. And our challenge is to organize one ride this month, within a month. How's that? And then my challenge is to the CEOs, CMOs, and we'll even throw in a COO if they want to. What the heck? Those guys can ride too.
Let's open the gates.
Let's throw
let's
it
let
down.
Anybody
They're
in.
All you guys, come on out, flex your muscle, go for a ride around the Long Beach IMS weekend, absorb the community, and let's make something great happen for motorcycling. Charles, thanks very much for buying me breakfast this morning. It was kind of you. And for riding with me, and I know we're going to get a chance to ride together soon, and thank you very much, buddy.
My pleasure.
All right. All right, Gassers, we'll see you guys out there down the road, hopefully soon. All right, take care. Bye.